What is missions? Well, as we seek to put feet to our faith, missions is the spearhead of the church to proclaim the good news in places where Christ has not been heard of. Missions is the front line of the church. Joel 2 speaks about them attacking like warriors. They climb the walls like soldiers. They all keep marching straight ahead, and they do not change direction or get in one another's way. The Lord thunders commands to his army. The troops that obey him are many and mighty. Missions is obedience to the Great Commission. Go then to all peoples everywhere and make them my disciples. Missions is the kingdom of God advancing. We read in Daniel 7 that Jesus was given authority, honor, and royal power so that the people of all nations, races, and languages would serve him. His authority would last forever and ever, and his kingdom would never end. Missions is the church reaching the whole world for Jesus. Acts 13 verse 47, for this is the commandment that the Lord has given us. I've made you a light for the Gentiles, so that the whole world may be saved. Missions is the church in action. The believers who were scattered went everywhere preaching the message, we read in Acts 8 verse 4, not just the apostles, all the believers. In Matthew 9 verse 35 to 38, read our Lord Jesus Christ commands his disciples, look at the fields. They're already ripe unto harvest. So the command is to look. We command to investigate. Read missionary newsletters, read missionary books, study Operation World, attend missionary conferences and report backs, learn about the field, look at the fields. Patrick Johnson of Operation World, which is one of the most phenomenally successful prayer guides in history. It started in South Africa and Rhodesia, actually. Patrick Johnson was a missionary of the Dorothea Mission, and he is doing film evangelism around Rhodesia, Madibeeland, southern Rhodesia, where I was brought up, what today is Zimbabwe. And organizing an apple crate, he put together study guides, information from letters, thousands of letters, sent all over the world, gathering information, and he started to put together in the book Operation World, which has gone through so many different editions in so many languages. He struggled for years to find a publisher. Many of the biggest publishers in the world said, there is no market for a intercessory prayer guide for the world or a missionary prayer guide to the nations. I mean, who wants an intercessory book? Well, so far his books have sold well over 15 million copies. Not bad for something that doesn't have a market. And Patrick Johnson's a member of our mission board. He's a friend, and he's been here in our mission, in this boardroom, a number of occasions. I've had the joy of organizing meetings and traveling with him too. He's also produced this phenomenal The Future of the Global Church book, which covers the history, the trends, and the possibilities of the church. No missiologist is a better statistician than Patrick Johnson. He has done the most comprehensive work on both missions history, what the situation is now, and the possibilities for the future. Our Lord Jesus commanded us, look at the fields. And then he said, pray to the Lord of the harvest that he may thrust out laborers into his harvest field. So the Lord Jesus commands us to look at the fields, which of course is a lot of what we've been doing at this Great Commission course. And he commands us to pray. We should be praying as individuals. We should be praying in groups. We should be praying as congregations. Congregations are meant to be a house of prayer for all nations. How many churches could be described as a house of prayer for all nations? I love it when I go into a church and I see they've got a world map, even more when they've got pictures of different missionaries that they're supporting and different things. They've got a missionary prayer notice board where they've got pinned up the prayer letters of different missions, and they've got a literature stand with the different prayer cards and newsletters of different missionaries of the church they support. And you can see that they're concerned. You go to a place like Back to the Bible Mission, and every day they're praying for different missions, different missionaries, different countries. When you're in that sort of situation, that's great. Sometimes you get to a church, and as you're about to leave the church, maybe the church door has a sign inside, or maybe they've got a sign at the end of their parking lot, you are now entering the mission field. That's great. To remind people, we're not a church for just our own benefit. We're to be prepared to fulfill the Great Commission, and the world is the field. We should be praying for the Muslim world. 1.6 billion people in the world are Muslims. We should be praying for countries that are under attack. This is the youngest country in the world, South Sudan. We should be praying for them. Our mission's done a huge amount of work there. We should be praying for the Muslim world, particularly in the 1040 window between the 10th and the 40th degrees latitude in the Northern Hemisphere, seeking to reach the most unreached. One of the prayer projects that we're involved in is IDOP, International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. For over 24 years, from the very beginning, we've been part of it, and we run IDOP Africa, International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Africa. The 11th of November last year was International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. It's always the second Sunday of November, International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Obviously, we want church to be praying for the persecuted church often, but to at least introduce them, some churches aren't doing it, to one Sunday in the year is a good start. And there's a lot of good resources to mobilize people to pray for the persecuted church. How do we get people to stop being selfish? Well, when you focused on the needs of others and you put a church on a missionary diet and you get them to look at the persecuted church, it puts our petty problems and concerns into perspective. And the things that I was complaining about now seem pretty minor compared to the testimonies of the persecuted church. And then we must send. Notice when the Lord said, look at the fields which are ripe unto harvest, pray to the Lord of the harvest to thrust out laborers into this harvest field. Who were the first ones to be sent? The very ones he told to pray. Next thing, he's telling all of the disciples in Matthew chapter 10 to go into highways and byways and compel them to come in and share the gospel. And so he sends them out on basically door-to-door street evangelism. Look, pray, send. Help others to serve God. Support, encourage, and pray for missionaries. Mobilize your congregation to support those who go. Do you know how many people I know who go into missions and then need people's support? But when they were earning a good living, having a good income, they weren't supporting you on the field. If we haven't been helping send others go, we can't expect others to help us go. It's so important that we invest. And I've maintained, even as a missionary, a principle of tithing to other missions, because we know other missions that are worse off than us. We know other missions that have less resource than us. We know people who are unlikely to be getting much support. So, for example, when we needed a new bucky, we donated our older bucky to a mission that was not as well off as us. When we need new station wagon, we donated our station wagon to another mission so that they could keep going. When we needed a new printer, we donated our printers, photocopiers, riser machines to others. Yes, we could have sold them or traded them in, but they're worth more to the kingdom than the little bit we could have got back. It was seed sowing in a practical way. It's so important that we donate to others, that we are involved in supporting others. And even a missionary who's struggling, well, if we donate 10% of what is given to us to other ministries, then it's also helping to keep things going. I think many times we've gone beyond 30, 40%. You don't want to be limited to 10, but 10% is a good start. And then to go. Pray, look, pray, send, go. When Jesus told his disciples to pray for workers to be sent, they became the first answers to their own prayers. We too must be prepared to put feet to our faith to go, whether across the street or across the border, as a witness to make disciples. So what is the goal of missions? The threefold goal of church planting is to establish self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating congregations. Put it this way, what's the job of a parent? Parents is to raise children who will become self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating. We want children who will become parents, who will be self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, and that they'll raise their children to be self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. You don't want to create a child who stays at home the whole time, needs mommy to do the washing, dad to pay the bills, and, you know, it gets a bit tedious when you get these kids in their 30s and 40s and 50s still staying at home and mommy and daddy still doing everything for them. But you find missionaries like that. You get missionaries. I remember going to Zimbabwe as a new missionary, talking about 1982, and speaking to a bitter, bitter, bitter missionary and his wife at the dinner table. And boy, were they bitter. Remember, Rhodesia just became Zimbabwe 2 years before. And we spent 42 years in this congregation, built this congregation, brought the people to the Lord, built this church brick by brick, been a pastor at this church for 42 years. And you know, they've all gone back to witchcraft, polygamy, and drunkenness since 1980. Now, I was sitting there, I didn't know much about anything, but I said, are you sure they went back to it? Maybe they never left it. I mean, maybe they've just come out and opened because now it's got a government where they felt free to behave like this. Maybe they were just acting. But what I didn't have the courage to say, but I should have said, is why were you still a pastor for 42 years? The Apostle Paul didn't stay anywhere more than 3 years. Some churches he is there for just a few months. He established a church, appointed elders and deacons, moved on to the next, wrote letters back, came back sometimes for follow-up. But he didn't suffocate the leadership of the church by doing it all for them. He left and he planted many churches. And then leaders were able to grow out of it. So imagine if I wanted to tie my children's shoelaces, brush their teeth, right into their 40s. They're 42 years old and you're still choosing their clothes, putting on their socks, brushing their teeth. This is ridiculous. You want to raise children who are going to be self-governing, self-supporting, self-propagating. And that's what a missionary should do. This man should have planted 20 churches in the previous 42 years. Why was he still a pastor there? I didn't have the courage to say that, but these were all going through my mind as a new missionary, just 22 years old, on my first mission to Zimbabwe. There are four stages of missionary activity. First, you're a pioneer, plowing, seed sowing, cultivating, harvesting, moving rocks, removing the thorn bushes, whatever it may be. So this is the first stage, being a pioneer. Secondly, you become a parent. You have the joy of leading someone to the Lord. Now you're spiritually a parent. And now you must disciple them. But at a certain point, you become a partner. Just like when your children start to get old enough to earn a living, get their own place, they're getting married and so on. Now you're no longer the parent in a sense. You're now a partner. You don't interfere with their new family. You can give advice. Hopefully they ask for it. But you're no longer running. I can't be running around and telling my daughter and her husband how they should do everything. But they sometimes ask my input and advice, which is fine. And so it is with churches we've established. At a certain point, they've got their own pastor, deacons, elders. And now you should come when they ask for help and assist where needed. And of course, pray for them. At a certain point, you become more like a participant where you're responding to the invitations to cooperate with local churches and mutual projects. We're no longer initiating. We're coming and doing what they ask. And this is when they are fully self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. So, to run over it again, the four stages, pioneer, parent, partner, participant. It's so important that we think like this and that we realize, where am I in the stage? Because if you're the pioneer, you've still got to do a lot more seed sowing, plowing, watering, and so on. When you're a parent, well, you've got a lot of responsibilities when you're discipling and raising. And of course, the younger they are, the more the responsibilities, the older they get, the less we, you know, now we can just tell them what to do. We don't have to do it for them, and so on. At a certain point, you don't have to tell them what to do. They are doing it if you've discipled them and raised them well. And then hopefully you come as a guest speaker now and then and help them with their Bible college or whatever they might need. So, missions. What we should look at is motives. And our mission's vision is Africa for Christ. But as we seek to put feet to our faith, we sometimes find there's some wrong motives. Let's start with the wrong motives. Before we get to good biblical motives, let's see with some wrong motives and some false calls. Because of human depravity, even the best of us can do some of the finest ministry with mixed motives. No less a missionary than David Livingston wrote in his diary, I'm much concerned that even when I'm involved in the best of activities, it's with mixed motives. And he was very dissatisfied with himself because he didn't have in his mind, under his critical analysis, pure enough motives. But you must not wait for your motives to be 100% pure before launching into missions, or you'll never get there. I mean, let's face it, one of the best things we can do is get into the work, and then we can expect God to purify our motives. So once you're in the mission field, you can expect God to thoroughly purify your motives, as I think any of our missionaries can say once they finally make it to the field. Was this Tanzania or was this Zambia? This is Zambia, up near Lake Tanganyika. Those who go to the mission field for predominantly wrong motives can cause a lot of grief to themselves and to those around them. So what are some examples of the wrong reasons for getting involved in missions? Number one, the desire to escape problems at home or work. Boredom, job dissatisfaction, in-law problems. Escaping to the mission field doesn't work because you tend to take your problems with you. Because let's face it, what's our biggest problem? Ourselves. It's our own attitudes. It's our own sinful desires. It's our own wrong motives. So a person who thinks, how many people escape from home into a marriage because I don't want people telling me what to do. Now I'm going to get married and then I'm going to be free. like you won't have somebody criticizing and telling you what to do when you're married. So how many people escape from, say, an abusive family and marry into an abusive marriage? It's extraordinary how many people do things like that. And the amount of people who come into the field because they're trying to escape problems at home. Well, it doesn't work like that. Secondly, another bad motive would be the desire to impress people. Missionary children particularly feel obligated to follow in their parents' footsteps. And I've come across people in the field who are so resentful of the mission field, resentful of their parents, and the fact that they were there and they didn't want to be there, and they were there primarily to try and impress their parents or to fulfill some expectation. Fear of disappointing your college teacher, your pastor, your church friends. So that won't keep you in the field very long. A desire to be more holy or dedicated than your peers. Bad motive. God's will is more important than what people think of you. This is almost like a Catholic works thing. If you're a really serious Catholic, you've got to become a monk or a nun, things like that, and suffer in a monastery, and then you really show you're spiritual. And for some Christians, some Protestants, mission field is the Catholic equivalent of becoming a monk or a nun. Bad motive. Thirdly, the desire to prove something to yourself. Well, let me tell you, the mission field is not the place to go for an ego trip. And there are people who go to the mission field for an ego trip. Fourthly, the desire to earn favor with God, this salvation by works mentality. I'm going to earn my salvation by suffering for the Lord, going to difficult place, enduring difficult people, that sort of thing. Fifthly, you get feelings of guilt and pity for being better off than the downtrodden masses who have been exploited and oppressed. The amount of times I've heard guilt manipulation at missions conferences, outrageous. The amount of, and you can do it so easily. How many Bibles do you have in your home? And there are people, they've got one Bible for 1,000 churchgoers, and they're taking a page of the Bible and swapping it around and make people feel guilty for having the Bibles instead of feeling grateful for having the Bibles. Instead of going to feel out of gratitude to God and out of love for your neighbor, they go out of a sense of guilt and pity. You threw away more food this last week than some people have for a meal in a whole week. And there's many ways that you can make people feel guilty instead of grateful and generous. And there's a lot of politics of guilt and pity today. Then there's emotionalism. Now, human emotions are God-given and they're essential, but emotion is not a good enough basis for a call. Yes, to go to the field because God commanded to go to the field because of love and concern for your neighbor, that's one thing. But to go just because you felt a high, and I've seen this, I'm loath to do it. When I was a new Christian, I stood up many a time in church camps, youth camps, conferences, rallies, where they were giving an emotional appeal to commit yourself to missions. And do you know, I remember seeing like just about the whole youth camp at Carmel Youth for Christ camp, for an Easter camp, standing response to this emotional appeal to commit your life to being a missionary. Huge amount of people running. And you know, I can still remember those people standing around. Not one of them ended up in the field. And how many felt guilty for not going? But if you're not called, what's the point? Okay, so what's holding you back? Are you in debt? You must pay it off. You cannot expect people to support a missionary who is using some of that to pay off their college debt or whatever. And it's shocking how much debt people can accumulate for university degrees that are normally quite worthless, actually. My wife, Lenora, she went to college, went to Northern Arizona University, did special ed education training. She got her degree, and she had a huge debt to pay off. And the mission board that she was being sent out to South Africa under to come to work with our mission said, well, we can't support you or send you until you pay off your college debt. She had to sell her car, things like this and so on, that she could get out of debt, that she would be debt-free to come here. I remember, now, I managed to work my way through college, working at Fire Brigade and so on to put myself through college. So I finished college without any college debt. That's pretty good. But at a certain point, God convicted me that the first mission I worked with, Hospital Christian Fellowship, I'd used their phone a lot without permission to phone my girlfriend back in Cape Town. I was over in Kempton Park Hospital Christian Fellowship. Hour-long phone calls. I mean, this could really chalk it up. And I felt so guilty about this when suddenly this restitution message burned itself in my heart. I left the field. I was in Mozambique at the time. Came back. Asked my dad if I could work with him. He was running the Western Province Cricket Union. I worked at Newlands Cricket Grounds for months to earn enough money to pay to the... Not that the mission even knew that I'd done it. This was restitution being done to give the money to cover the phone calls that I knew was a debt in God's accounting, even if they didn't know about it. And I didn't feel free to go back to the field until I'd paid off my debt. So debts are a major reason why many people don't end up in the field. Are you getting too much education? When John Calvin, 27-year-old doctor of theology, author of the Institutes of the Christian Religion, was passing through Geneva. He only intended to be in Geneva one night. William Farrell came to him and sought to encourage him to become the pastor of Geneva because he had read the Institutes. He knew this man was eloquent, studious, outstanding. He has the mind we need. Of course, French-speaking. Geneva's French-speaking. And so William Farrell tried to recruit John Calvin. John Calvin was set on being a full-time student. He wanted more and more and more degrees. He wanted to spend his life in literary ease and study. And William Farrell, tall, red-bearded man, stood up and from his full height thundered, "May God curse your studies. If now, in an hour of need, you refuse help to Christ's church." And he threatened to pray imprecatory prayers against Calvin. And John Calvin testified that the fear of God, the terror of God came upon him. And he submitted his will to serving the Lord. Now, I think there's a lot of people you've got to say this to. There's a lot of people who want to get more and more and more education. I mean, here we are going to, in many cases, evangelize illiterates. But you know, you've got to get your masters and or doctorates and so on. In many cases, we sometimes educate ourselves beyond the ability to even relate to the people we call to evangelize to. There's a place for academic study, but it's got to be in balance. And I've seen so many people who study and study, and many times the study is an escape from actually doing the work and actually being in the real world. I was in the field first. Then I went for study. And when I was studying, I knew what I was studying for. And every single weekend I was out evangelizing. Every holiday, the day we finished college, I was already driving up on my motorbike up the N1 to get to Mozambique and to evangelize for the whole holidays and coming back. I knew what I was studying for. I got far more out of it than the other students who were sort of wasting their time and sort of drifting through and sleeping through the lectures and things like this. And you'd get the... Now, for example, when I was at Baptist Theological College, I was never doing less than 8 subjects a semester. Sometimes I did 9, one semester, even did 10 subjects, which was insane. Most students were doing 4 or 5 subjects a semester. But I want to get through as quick as possible. And so I was doing the maximum amount possible, and I was pushing myself through it, but I had a 8-hour night, 6-day a week duty at the fire brigade, and I was working midnight shift 3 to 8. They actually pushed it to 11:30 to 7:30 so that I could get to college at 8, and almost everyone was willing to trade their times because nobody wanted the midnight shift, and so I only wanted the midnight shift. And it was, for me, a matter of honor to not study on a Sunday and to be available for preaching. The amount of students that come to me with 4 or 5 subjects. "Peter, could you take my sermon on Sunday? You know, I've got an assignment on Monday." Well, I had 2 assignments on Monday. But I'd never say no. I'd always take the opportunity to minister because I knew what I was studying for. Studying for the field. I mean, I would choose subjects for assignments that I knew I could use in the field. And time and again, I've turned back to them because my time at college wasn't wasted. Some other people, well, who knows what. But I've had to warn some people, including my own son-in-law, who's once he is getting his master's, he is interested in getting his doctorate before coming in, and had to say, you know, "May God curse your studies if you just want to get in the field. You've already got a master's, for goodness sakes." I mean, you know, he's magna cum laude. He's top of the class. Hunter's the kind of person who felt nervous if his assignment wasn't ready a month before the due date. My daughter and I were always happy if we could get ready on time. And he's a real academic. He's a serious student. I mean, you can see he really knows his stuff. But we had to kind of threaten him to get it over with and get in the field. You can get your doctorate at a later stage. Just You've got enough for now. Work on this. Many people are over. In fact, my father-in-law, Bill Bathman, said the church is dying by degrees. Number three, are you falling in love with someone who's not committed to missions? This is one of the biggest. How many times have I met somebody? I was called to missions, but then I met so-and-so and we got married and so on and so forth. Well, I was 24 when I met the girl of my dreams. She was everything I could have ever hoped for. And she was absolutely perfect in my mind and ticked every one of the boxes. Her mother is German. Father's English, same as my parents. Parents are missionaries. She's brought up in a mission field. She's an artist. I mean, a writer needs artists too. I mean, how great is that? Quite a lot of the artwork we've got. In fact, the ones I showed you of what's in a field trip and so on, she did that. A lot of our best artwork were done by her. And so I was head over heels in love with Anne. She is the best. She is exactly what I wanted. But the moment we got engaged, her interest in mission suddenly disappeared, and she is trying to put pressure on me to become a pastor. Now, Father ran a denomination. I was being offered a really good pastorate, two vehicles, nice man. Good. So you could still go on missions once a year, you know, on your holidays. And I had to make a choice. Now, she's a good person, still friends of my family. My wife and her have tea. My children are friends with her children. We're not enemies. But I wasn't the right person for her. She wasn't the right person for me, even though we both thought at the time. But we had different callings and visions. And it would have been disastrous if I'd let my choice of marriage partner get in the way of God's call to the mission field. Are your parents opposed to your going? Most parents are. How many times have I heard, when are you going to stop wasting your life? Get a real job, work for a real boss, do some real work, do something else, and you know, you're wasting your life. And this is common. We had a girl in our mission program whose mother regularly sent lies to, you know, that she's dying and all sorts of things to get her child to come out of the field and fly back home. And she cried wolf time and again. It was all lies and all, created all kinds of crises at home to get their daughter back and out the field. And, it is disastrous, but this girl was very steadfast. She stayed the course. But boy, parents can really seek to undermine your work sometimes. Now, must you honor your parents? Yes. But when you're out of the home, earning your own living, you know, over 21, so on, you must honor your parents, but it doesn't mean you've got to obey them. My parents, for example, were horrified I got baptized because they felt that that was rejecting them because that apparently had me baptized an infant. Well, first I'd heard of it was when I got baptized as a believer. They never took me to Sunday school. I wasn't confirmed. My parents didn't go to church. I didn't read the Bible or pray at home. Suddenly I'm rejecting my parents because I get baptized as a believer. They've even told me I'd been baptized as an infant. You know, what meaning is that? But you can get parents throwing all kinds of stumbling blocks. So I had to go against my parents' will into the field. But you still got to honor them, but you don't have to obey them when you are out of the home and earning your own living. Are you worried about your safety? Well, if you're not, don't take anything into the mission field you're not willing to lose. That includes your own life. You have to be willing to die. Not just to self, but physically too. It can happen. It has happened. Are you afraid of failing? Many people don't go in the mission field because they're afraid of failing. They're afraid of failing to acquire the language, failing to get the support, failing to whatever. Are you afraid of dirt, disease, and discomfort? Well, let me assure you, most mission fields have a lot of dirt, a lot of disease, and a lot of discomfort, which is one reason why we take people out of their comfort zones and get you into some places you would normally go doing Great Commission course. Yes, you can get wet. Yes, you can walk in rivers. And yes, you can walk in the jungle, in the forest, in the middle of the night without any, without having any of your torches on and things like that. Are you worried about your children? Of course, we do worry about our children. But you know, children brought up in the mission field, often happier. So, well, Emma can say, you probably feel sorry for this poor kids brought up in the city and not homeschooled and not brought up in the field.
How boring.
Indeed. You can ask my son Calvin what he thought He was horrified when he discovered that kids who go to school had to sit in desks and be quiet. I mean, can you believe it? Hideous. Whereas he managed to go in the field with me. We climbed Mount Majuba. We swam the Zambezi River. We were able to go and discover battle sites, museums, monuments, meet the people in the field. He knows more geography from mission trips and more history from our travels than he ever could have learned from a book in any classroom. The greatest hindrance to missionary work is self. Self that refuses to sacrifice. Self that refuses to give. Self that refuses to go. Go ye therefore. So why do many resist the call to missions? The myth of the super spiritual missionary. There's unrealistic estimations of the spiritual qualifications required. Now, missionaries are just ordinary Christians who face the same struggles, the same infirmities as other Christians. We get sick. We get depressed. We have problems. Yet, responding to the Great Commission is the main thing. The myth of the super spiritual missionary is just that. It's a myth. Not even the greatest missionaries on the planet. David Livingstone, Mary Slessor, Robert Moffat, William Carey, Robert Morrison, Adoniram Judson. None of them were free from infirmities and doubts and problems and feelings of inadequacy. Number two, there's the burden of deputation. The hard work of promoting missions, recruiting prayer supporters, inspiring others into missions, getting your home church involved, it's essential, but it's daunting. It's not nice. As Lenora said yesterday, it's the least popular part of missions for most people because, you know, we don't want to do that. We want to be in the field, but, you know, encouraging people to be your prayer support behind is a vital part. Thirdly, there's the reluctance to make a lifelong commitment. The most efficient expenditure of resources is career commitment. Yet the existentialism of the now generation militates against long-term commitment. Most people just want a 1 or 2 week experience and, you know, get the t-shirt. And that's it. But we need to be committed for life, to do God's will, to be flexible as to where and how God may direct us to accomplish this. Take my father-in-law, Bill Bathman. 67 years in missions. First in Europe, ministering into Eastern Europe, smuggling Bibles into the Iron Curtain countries, everywhere from Russia in the north through to China, Albania, everything in between. And when he was 71 years old, celebrating 50 years of missions, we took him up to Sudan, to the mission field, had to plan this secretly because I'm sure my wife and mother-in-law would not approve taking a 71-year-old great-grandfather into the field. But he loved it so much after we flew him into the battlefront and so on. You know what he did? Got back to Cape Town. He bought a Land Cruiser, filled it with supplies, trailer and so on, drove it overland to Sudan to donate it to the church in Sudan and deliver it to our mission base and the chapels and everything else. So after flying him to the mission field, he wanted to drive Africa overland. That's a long way. That's 8,000 kilometers one way. And so how's that? You know, give me that mountain. He was still going. Do you know, Bill Bathman was able to be banned from the pulpit at age 89, his last year of life on earth. He was banned from the pulpit of his home church because he gave an altar call. And he preached like the people were sinners and needed to repent. I mean, can you believe it? The audacity. So, you know, that's an example. Bill Bathman, when he is younger, I've met people who said, Bill Bathman, he would go into a bar in England and ask the bartender if he could just turn off the music for a moment and stand on the bar counter, and he'd preach the gospel to people and say, and he'd say, just give me 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, he said, he always stuck to time. If anyone wants to hear more, come speak to me out afterwards. And he would go outside, and there's always people who came from the bars, and he led people to Christ in the bars. I mean, this sort of, I've met people who were led to the Lord that way. So, you know, here's a man who's flexible. He was in his 70s when he moved home to Cape Town, South Africa, and so on. The reticence to learn another language. Now, the negative experiences of many people in foreign language class at school discourage him from attempting to learn to communicate the gospel in the field through a foreign language. I don't know about you, but I didn't have very good experiences in class learning Latin or learning Greek or Hebrew or Afrikaans. I mean, the classroom experience was, to be honest, frustrating, not very inspiring at all. But when you learn the field, it's actually far more meaningful. There's many mission fields in Africa, by the way, where English, French, and Portuguese are needed. English, French, and Portuguese gets you through most of Africa and people's second language, at least. So that's not so difficult, is it? And then when you're learning in a field, you know, the amount of people who want to learn Arabic, say in Michigan. Well, if you want to learn Arabic, why not go and study at the University of Cairo in Egypt and learn Arabic in the mission field amongst the people? You get your degree while you're in the field. I mean, why must we learn a foreign language at home? Why not do something like what Andrew Murray did? When Andrew Murray wanted to learn Dutch, what did he do? He went to Holland, got his degree in Holland, because he's going to be first missionary to the Voortrekkers. And he was sent out, the first Dutch Reformed Church missionary to the Voortrekkers, went to Bloemfontein and so on. But he did his training in Netherlands, because at that stage they preached in Netherlands and read from the Netherlands Bible. That's the way to learn. Language learning in the field while communicating the gospel is far more enjoyable and workable experience. Many people stay from the field, away from the field, because of the fear of failure. They fear they'll fail to raise enough support, fail to adjust to a new culture, fail to learn a new language. And the fear of a tough, demanding, dangerous, or difficult job in unfamiliar circumstances. The fear of the unknown deters many from launching out in obedience and faith. But nothing ventured, nothing gained. You should take the example of John Mark. John Mark was a failure who deserted Paul. Mark is identified as the man who's carrying the jar when the two disciples were sent to find a place to prepare for the celebration of the Passover. John Mark was the young man who on the night when the Lord was betrayed and arrested was following Jesus wearing a linen garment. He is seized, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. John Mark accompanied the Apostle Peter on his missionary outreaches in Jerusalem and Judea. It was in John Mark's mother's home that the church met for prayer when the Apostle Peter was in prison. When his uncle Barnabas and Paul returned from Jerusalem, they brought John Mark with them to Antioch. And when the Apostle Paul and Barnabas set off on the first great missionary journey of the church from Antioch, John Mark went with them. And after their successful outreach in Cyprus, they traveled to Perga and Pamphylia, where John Mark left them. He returned to Jerusalem. The scripture doesn't mention the reasons. Was it the dangers? Was it homesickness? Was it his zeal had ebbed? Was it his courage had failed him? Mark deserted the elderly Barnabas and the sickly Paul, leaving them to scale the mountain passes to the Pisidian Antioch by themselves. When Paul and Barnabas set off on their second missionary journey, Barnabas wanted to take John, called Mark, with him. But Paul did not think it wise to take him because he had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with them in the work. They had such a sharp disagreement, they parted company. Barnabas took Mark, sailed to Cyprus, Paul chose Silas. First missionary split, and he was the reason. Happily, though, that's not the last we hear of John Mark. Despite this unpromising beginning to his missionary career, John Mark came back. He is later reconciled with Paul. He proved himself in the field. In later years, he became a faithful co-worker of the Apostle Paul. So we read in Colossians 4:10, my fellow prisoner, Articus sends you his greetings, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. You have received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him. Wow. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you too, because he is helpful to me in my ministry. 2 Timothy is written during Paul's second prison experience, shortly before the end of his life. From initially being a failure and a deserter and a quitter and a man who put his hand to the plow and looked back, had gone backwards, causing a sharp disagreement and division between his cousin Barnabas and the Apostle Paul, John Mark went on to repent, to restore, to make restitution, to rebuild Paul's trust in him, so much so that Paul can describe him as helpful to me in my ministry. And he also is mentioned as one of his co-workers in the book of Philemon. There's a general lack of direction and commitment in the church. There's a paralyzing passivity and inertia. The command of Jesus comes to those churches, look at the fields. Commitment and obedience will open up God's blessings. So why are many who respond to the call sidetracked? Many get sidetracked by marrying someone who's not willing to be a missionary. The tension between honoring our parents and obeying the Lord. And financial debts, unwise choices, living beyond our means. But Christ must come first.